Good afternoon. My name is Kelly, and I will be your conference operator today. At this time, I would like to welcome everyone to the Centers for American Progress conference call. All lines have been placed on mute to prevent any background noise. After the speaker's remarks, there will be a question-and-answer session. If you would like to ask a question during this time, simply press star, then the number one on your telephone keypad. If you would like to withdraw your question, press the pound key. Thank you. I will now turn the call over to Angela Kelly to begin.
Thank you. Thank you very much, and thanks to all the participants on today's call. Today, the Center for American Progress is releasing a report entitled How Georgia's Anti-Immigration Law Could Hurt the States and the Nation's Economy. As everyone knows, last spring, Georgia enacted HB 87, following the footsteps of Arizona's SB 1070. It was a harsh immigration law that included a range of provisions, from making it a crime to harbor and transport undocumented people to empowering police to check immigration status. The Arizona law, the Georgia law, have both been enjoined. Many provisions of the laws have not gone into effect. But that doesn't mean that the impact of the law on the state of Georgia hasn't been felt. In fact, it has struck a blow to the agriculture industry in Georgia that is heavily reliant on immigrant farm labor. This shouldn't come as a surprise. Over 200 agribusiness leaders petitioned the state house in the debate leading up to the bill's passage, asking that they not pass the law, anticipating the harm that would come to the state's economy. So today's conversation is going to provide insights into what's happened in the last many months since the law has passed, recognizing that the full effects of this law won't be felt for many years. And frankly, the early story is a grim one. There's an estimated economic impact of between $300 million to $1 billion, and we'll hear a breakdown of those numbers as the author of the report will tell us stories from Georgia and make it clear that the impact is quite real and will be quite lasting. We'll hear about a blueberry grower, for example, that is experiencing a 60% shortage in his labor and having to leave nearly $500,000 worth of crops in the fields. This is all happening in a state that has a $1.3 billion budget shortfall, certainly not a state in a position to be leaving money on the table. The paper further examines the reality of what it would take to replace migrant labor. It'll look into the challenges of replacing it with labor that's not experienced in picking crops, what would happen if we switch to mechanized crops, and the economic impact that would approach $800 million. We'll also look into issues of if these laws are successful in driving out foreign labor, as the neighboring state of Alabama also seems to be attempting to do. Where would we get this food from, and what would be the reality if we had to import food, raising questions of food security? And all around this debate is, I think, frankly, the obvious policy solution, and one that federal lawmakers need to be aware of and need to act on, of instead of trying to enforce our way out of this problem, in fact, providing legal channels for people who are unauthorized to come forward so that they can work legally and be in the system. That was the subject of a hearing today in the Senate Judiciary Committee. So this is clearly a hot topic, which is why we wrote this paper. And today to talk about the paper, we have two folks. One is the author of the paper, Tom Baxter. Tom is a journalist and has been one for over 30 years in the state of Georgia. He was the editor and chief political correspondent of the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. He's a current editor of the Southern Political Report. He is a fellow at the Dole Institute at the University of Kansas, and we were thrilled to have him write this paper and to have him on today's call. Following Tom will be Mayor Paul Bridges. Paul is the mayor of Uvalde, Georgia. He's a native Georgian, born in Vidalia, Georgia. And as a mayor, Paul Bridges has been at the front line in experiencing what's been the law's impact. He has been a vocal opponent to the law, has testified at Senate hearings, and has in fact sued his home state because of the impact of the law and the harm that he sees unfolding. Also on the call, we have Sarah Glynn, a colleague of mine here at the Center for American Progress, who's done some analysis of switching to mechanized crops, and she's available to us as a resource person if any of the questions want to delve into that analysis in depth. So why don't we turn to you, Tom, and if you can just give us some of the highlights from the report and tell us what you found.
Thank you, Angela. And as you know, agriculture is heavily dependent on the weather, which is one of the reasons why the impact of this bill was felt so swiftly and sharply here in Georgia. Farmers down in South Georgia, fruit and vegetable growers, knew that they were facing a particularly hot and dry summer season, and so they put their crops in early and then waited for the migrant labor, which always shows up to pick those crops, and in many areas experienced severe shortfalls. And it was for that reason that even before the law went into effect, the director of the Georgia Agribusiness Council was able to estimate that the initial losses from this labor shortage would be in the neighborhood of $300 million this year. And the overall cost, factoring in the secondary impact of the labor shortage, could approach $1 billion. So we wanted to take a look at that, see if we could substantiate those numbers, and certainly there are tremendous losses that it's been established that there have been. But one of the reasons sometimes it's difficult to ascertain precisely what agricultural losses would be is that you can always grow something. If you don't grow labor-intensive crops like onions and peaches or blueberries, you can grow crops that are mostly mechanically harvested these days, like peanuts and cotton and hay. If you look at Table 2 in our report, you see that there's a really sharp difference in the economic impact of crops. An acre of peanuts, for instance, and peanuts account for more than 500,000 acres of Georgia's agricultural land, produces about $757 in what's called farm gate value. Farm gate value refers to the value of a crop when it leaves the farm before any processing or transportation costs are added on. $757 for peanuts, for probably the most successful row crop that we have, mechanically harvested crop that we have in Georgia currently, cotton. There's over 1 million acres in production, but those acres only produce an average farm gate value of $693 an acre. In contrast that with the fruits and vegetables, which are hand-picked, labor-intensive crops. Blueberries, for instance, produce a farm gate value of $6,268. Onions, and Georgia's known for its Vidalia onions, produce a farm gate value of $9,705. So you can see that even if a crop, a hand-picked crop, can be placed with another, the difference in the economic value and the value lost is considerably greater. Looking here at Table 3, we see that statewide we have now about 134,000 acres of hand-picked crops. If you were to replace all those crops with peanuts, this is a hypothetical consideration, but in fact, a great many acres are being converted over to mechanized crops already. The total value lost would be a whopping $796 million. And that refers to, as I say, just to farm gate value. When you look at the impact value farther down the line, it can be much greater. That larger number, the $1 billion estimate earlier in the year, factored in the losses that would come from the losses affecting feed stores, supply stores, and all the other attendant businesses that work with agriculture. So it's those are big numbers, of course. But when you look more closely into the issue, there are also some larger impacts and some more long-term impacts that are just as significant or greater. And particularly, the impact on small farms in contrast to larger farms is something that very little attention has been paid to in this debate, and it's something that affects not only the economy but the culture of the agricultural South. If you look at Table 4, we take an average farm of 212 acres, which in the greater scope of things would be a pretty small farm. If you were to replace hand-picked crops on a farm of that size with peanuts, the average expected loss would be $1.2 million. Small farmers in South Georgia cited similar figures to me in their own personal estimate of what their losses would be. And a loss of that magnitude would probably put most small farmers under, also most small specialty farmers like Jared Pruer, who we quote in the report, a former ag professor at the University of Georgia who retired and started a small organic blueberry farm over in St. Mary. He's one of a number of people who doesn't really know if he can continue to produce his crop if he doesn't have that migrant labor to depend on. And then there's the larger impact, too, of the way it's an impact that doesn't just affect Georgia. Already, agribusiness folks in Michigan are talking about how the disruption in the supply line of migrant labor, laborers who didn't get to Georgia very often also didn't get to Michigan this year. And they're projecting very large losses even as far away as that. So when we talk about dollar figures and losses, the estimates out of Georgia are very substantial, but they could be magnified by a great deal, and particularly if we see the Alabama and South Carolina laws coming online over the next year have a greater impact, and if Florida, which is going to be considering an immigration law again this coming year, were to do this, it would be very substantial. One reason for that is that this area of the country is perfectly placed to be, as Jason Shaw, one a Republican legislator who voted for the bill, says, the region is in very good position to be the principal supplier for grocery shelves up and down the East Coast. If those crops don't come from the Southeast, they're going to come from somewhere else, and very often they're going to come from another country. And that means that that incidents like this chlamydia scare that we've seen in the last couple of weeks are going to become more and more likely, or at least we can say that food security, health, and safety standards that now are regulated in Georgia will be in the hands of others. And the ultimate impact also of more or less, I guess you could say, outsourcing our blueberries and onions is going to be inevitably higher prices at the grocery store for Americans. And I will leave it at that for the moment and come back with more questions later.
Thank you so much, Tom. And let me just mention two things before we turn to our next and last speaker. One is that the report can be found online at AmericanProgress.org, AmericanProgress.org. And the second is that this call is being recorded. Thank you very much, Tom. That was a terrific presentation. Why don't we turn to our next speaker, Paul Bridges, the mayor of Uvalde. What have you seen on the ground, Paul?
Well, first of all, the report, I've read it twice, and it's really spot on. I don't know anything about the calculations and computations, but I can say that that the premises in this report are absolutely correct. When HB 87 was passed, excuse me, and the governor signed into law, the many people who were skilled laborers who had been living in our area for a long time moved and left the state. And then some of the ones who stayed in the state, their relatives and friends who typically pass through this area moving from state to state, did not come. Our area quickly realized that the people who had been coming and trading with us and living in our area during the harvesting season of the blueberries and blackberries and the ending of the onion season did not come. We fell really short, way short of the number of skilled labor hands that we had in the fields from our previous years. In talking with some of the local farmers, they are going to cut way back on the number of acres that they plant in onions. One farmer said that he just can't risk putting crops into the ground that he can't be assured that are going to be harvested in the early spring. So instead of planting the 200 acres of Vidalia onions, he's going to plant 20 or 30, and then the remainder he will put in other machine crops. He made an interesting comment to me. He said, before when we first started planting the Vidalia onions, we only planted what we thought we could harvest. And as the migrant labor came in, they increased their fields in size and the production itself increased, and they found quicker and better ways of doing it. And so they planted more fields, but with the expected labor shortage in the spring, they are not going to plant the onion crops. The interesting thing about onion crops is that they're planted in the winter, in November and December, the onions are planted, and they grow off in the early spring. After the onions are harvested, then there's another crop that can be planted because of the growing season. So instead of now having a two-crop field, they are going to have only a one-crop field. The interesting impact that I've seen is how the community has been torn apart. We've had families who have documented people in the family and undocumented, and even U.S. citizens in the same family, and many of these have had to leave the state because they didn't want to risk the dangers of this new HB 87 impacting their family or separating the family, so they left for a safer state, you know, in order to live in a safer state. And when they left, then we saw that the homes that they had either bought trailers and moved on to a piece of property that they bought are now being vacated. These people are very family oriented. So when I went over to a blueberry field that was not being picked and talked to the owner, he explained that the pickers just didn't come this morning. He didn't know why, other than HB 87, and that they were here yesterday. And so I went over to in a neighboring county where some of the people had come from, and they were over packing up to leave. And one of the guys was fixing up his trailer so he could leave and sell his trailer and leave. And what I found was that this entire area was occupied by families and family friends who had bought this area of property and built it up and moved trailers in. In their yards were plants that had been bought at Lowe's or Walmart. They had a really nice landscaped yards, and these were families that were leaving. One of the children was a senior in high school, and because of HB 87, this family left. Now, it doesn't just impact those families. It impacts the friends and relatives of those families who are leaving. As I mentioned, some of these are citizens of the U.S., and what's happened is that one of their parents would be undocumented, and the entire family leaves, which separates the grandparents from those children, and the influence that we all know is a great benefit for our young minds to have the input of their grandparents in their lives. And that's why I say that we have a rip in our social fabric, because we are separating families based on fear of the impact of this law. And I know that here in my little town, we've had two houses that were dilapidated and were purchased by Latinos, and then that property was put back into the tax base with an increase in the tax base. And so it bothers me whenever I hear terms like, well, they don't pay taxes, whenever, in fact, they do pay taxes, and not only that, they increase the value of the property that they've purchased, so that that property tax gets increased and increases our tax base. I'm saying all that to say that I believe that Georgia has made a terrible mistake in enacting HB 87.
Thank you so much, Mayor Bridges. Operator, could you give instructions to the participants on how they can queue up to ask a question?
Yes, if you would like to ask an audio question, please press star, then the number 1 on your telephone keypad. We'll pause for just a moment to compile the Q&A roster.
Can I chip in while we're waiting here?
Sure.
I might just say to a couple of the points that Paul was speaking of, you hear these stories all over South Georgia. I talked with one cotton gin operator who's actually moved his foreman's trailer onto the property. The foreman has his papers. His wife doesn't. So if she were to drive to the grocery store, she'd be in jeopardy of being stopped and come under the strictures of the law. And so they've adopted this rather uncomfortable, I think, but necessary measure of actually moving the trailer onto the gin property so that this gentleman's wife never has to leave. That's almost a form of imprisonment.
Good story. Thank you very much, Tom.
I know of two situations very similar to that, where the foreman at the onion warehouse is a U.S. citizen and is married to an undocumented, and that woman will not leave the home. And then a guy named Gary came to my house the other day, and he's also married to an undocumented. They have a child, and she had children before him, and very similar, where the only time that those undocumented children leave are to go to school, and the only time she leaves the home is only in his presence, and then only in necessity. So that is not uncommon, what you've just described.
Well, thank you, gentlemen. Those are very accurate and descriptive images for those of us who aren't in Georgia. Why don't we see if anyone has queued up to ask a question?
Yes, you have a question from Mary Silver.
Hello. I've been following this closely. It is heartbreaking. Do you guys have any real hope that in our political climate we're going to be able to work out a good legal solution to this?
I'll throw that one to Paul initially, I think, or to Angie, I think, could speak.
Sure. So why don't I take a crack at that in terms of what's possible legislatively, and we haven't had many signs of hope from Washington. I mean, frankly, it's been deafening silence, particularly in the wake of Arizona, Georgia, now Alabama, and a handful of other states that have passed. You know, at each turn, it feels like more and more restrictive laws. And particularly as the fallout from Alabama has only just begun, we can only hope that it sends a signal to Washington that they need to set aside what has just been extraordinary partisan fighting and instead focus on a solution. There are a number of legislative efforts that have come up, both big and small, being an effort to try to pass a measure of protection and for unauthorized youth, known as the DREAM Act, last December, which did pass the House, and it fell short in the Senate by just a few votes. We also saw back in 2006 where there was a comprehensive immigration bill passed with 23 Republican supporters in the Senate. But the House action was all enforcement all the time. And unfortunately, it feels like the House has remained in that mode the last many years and is only focused on enforcement. If you look today, for example, there were two hearings happening in Washington this morning, one on the Senate side, which, as I mentioned, was very much focused on the impact of our broken immigration system on the agriculture industry. So you had the Commissioner of Agriculture, for example, from Georgia testifying, along with a handful of other experts, you know, digging in deep into what we're talking about today. and frankly looking for a solution. You know, what? How can we ensure we have a stable legal workforce? That's what the Senate was talking about. In contrast, in the House side, in the Homeland Security Subcommittee, they're having a conversation about how to limit the president's authority to decide how to prioritize who to deport and who not to deport, and frankly just name-calling and bickering about the president's effort, the Department of Homeland Security's effort to prioritize removals. So very different conversations happening in the two bodies, and I'm afraid that we haven't hit rock bottom yet, that we're going to have to see more state laws pass, more children too afraid to come to school, more families having to pack up, as has been described what's happening in Georgia, or families living essentially under house arrest because they're too afraid to drive. And I'm afraid we're going to have more and more of that until finally federal lawmakers will act. But I appreciate the question because you really are asking, what is the solution? I think there are some good ideas out there in agriculture. Certainly the Ag Jobs Bill, which has been around for years, I think would be a significant step in the right direction for the agriculture industry. But sadly, there hasn't been enough political cooperation on Capitol Hill.
And let me just quickly add, too, we've seen in the past couple of weeks stories out of Oklahoma and Florida in which key Republican legislative leaders have expressed great reluctance about moving forward with any kind of similar law in their states. And I think what we are likely to see here is a sort of a patchwork where you have some states with very restrictive laws, some states that don't go in that direction, and more or less a chaotic sort of situation for a migrant industry that depends on moving from state to state.
Mary, it's my hope that any states considering laws like Georgia will review the work done, such as this report by Tom, to see the negative effects of destroying the tax base and the labor base in their own states, and see the economic and social impacts that this sort of law would have in their own state, and hope that they will use some common sense rather than the rhetoric that's being used today.
Thank you. If you would like to ask a question, please press star, then the number one on your telephone keypad. Your next question comes from Jeffrey Tapia.
Hi, thank you. I'm Jeffrey Tapia. I'm the Chief Operating Officer of the Latin American Association in Atlanta. I'd like to thank you for this great information. And my question is regarding other industries. Do we have any statistics and data at this point on the restaurant industries, carpet, poultry? I know poultry is part of agriculture, but specifically poultry, the hotel business, and small, mom-and-pop stores. Do we have any information on how they're being affected at this time?
Tom, did you run into that in your research, or Paul, have you seen that from your perch as an elected official?
Well, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Paul.
Well, I'm sorry, Tom. I've been in touch with the mayor of Dalton. Dalton is the carpet capital of the world, they claim, and the impact has been tremendous in Dalton. They are concerned about what's going to happen with the labor force in Dalton. And the jury is still out on that. Several families have left. One business walked into the bank and turned the key over to the bank and said, "I can no longer do my business because I won't have the base to do the purchasing." So it's affecting us in Georgia in the carpet industry as well.
One reason we didn't get into the subject of the poultry industry in this report is that the situation is a little bit different. As with the carpet industry, most of the Hispanic workers in that industry are here more. They have papers, but they're here more or less permanently. And for instance, the poultry industry already uses E-Verify, which is one of the controversial aspects of this bill. But as Paul says, it's not just the worker at the plant or the plucking plant who's affected. It's the family, the larger family, and in many cases, these industries are going to lose part of their workforce because this law affects those extended families, which are so important to them. And by the way, we did not, in talking about agriculture, we excluded poultry, but we also excluded the landscaping industry. It's awfully hard to talk about. You know, you can't really put a farm gate value on landscaping. But from what I've heard, it's going to be severely impacted, particularly in the metro Atlanta area.
Can you hear me? I don't know if I'm on mute. I know the restaurant industry is very impacted as well.
Yes.
All right. Do we have any other questions from the press?
Yes, you have a question from Blake Aud.
Oh, yeah. Hi, Tom. I was actually going to ask about the poultry industry, too, so I think we already covered that.
Yeah, poultry is its own big subject, and as you know, poultry is the largest agricultural enterprise in the state. It's a different animal, but it is anything that affects the immigration status of anybody in a family is likely to have an impact on that industry.
Are there any other questions, Kelly?
Yes, your next
question. You... Go ahead, thank you.
Your next question comes from Jonathan Shapiro.
Hey, I was just wondering what other states outside of Georgia and the ones that have already enacted laws are the ones that are closest to enacting their own.
You mean what's the next set of states likely to take it up?
Yeah. I mean, it sounds like one of the main goals of this report is to warn other states of the economic consequences of this type of law. And so is there a group of states, or are there individual states that y'all are targeting?
Not specifically. I mean, Florida flirted and came dangerously close to enacting a similar law, and frankly, what turned the tide against Florida was the impact on tourism and agriculture. So, you know, similarly, Texas was flirting with a basket of laws like this. Virginia has also talked about it, as has North Carolina. So there's a range of states. And my organization about a year ago looked at the conference, the impact of the Arizona law on, conference cancellations. And so it very much depends on the state, what kind of impact it's going to have. We thought for this state, it was obvious that the agriculture industry was the most impacted. If Florida were to pass a similar law, I think tourism and ag. So it very much depends on the state, but I do think, you know, you're right in that a purpose, a goal of this this report, like the Arizona conference cancellation report, is to send a warning signal to all states. There isn't, I don't know that there's a single state in the U.S. right now that has such a healthy economy that it can leave millions of dollars on the table. But we think it's important to warn all states, therefore, that that's really what's at stake if they go down this path.
Okay. And can I just get your last name? For the record?
Sure. My last name is Kelly, K-E-L-L-E-Y, and my first name is Angela.
Speaking just a little bit more about Florida, which in this region of the country and in terms of agribusiness is really critical. Florida, as Angie said, came close to passing a law in this last year, and as I am told, the critical moment in that debate came in a very emotional speech from a Republican legislator who also happens to be a berry grower. But Governor Rick Scott has said that he wants to make an immigration law a priority in his next session. And even though, as I mentioned before, there are some Republican leaders in the legislature who are reluctant to do that, I think we're going to see Florida as absolutely, just in the same way we're going to see Florida having a big impact in the presidential nomination, the debate over immigration next year in the Florida legislature is going to be very key.
Your next question comes from Gustavo Martinez.
Hi, Gustavo Martinez in Mundo Hispanic in Atlanta. I have a couple questions for you guys. Well, I don't know if you covered this already, but I lost my connection for a while, so if I'm being redundant, please excuse me, but I need to know if you guys have cover the impact of E-Verify within your report, and also what is the impact of mechanized agriculture that some or at least a few growers are proposing or thinking about to do for the next season?
On that first question, the impact, I'm sorry, I missed the on the first part of that question, the impact of what?
E-Verify.
Oh, E-Verify.
Yes, so this is Angie. We've looked into E-Verify at a national level because it is a vigorous debate that's happening on Capitol Hill. And the truth about E-Verify is that it's not ready for prime time. Only 4% of all U.S. businesses are currently covered under E-Verify. So putting E-Verify on steroids is guaranteed to do a couple things. One, it's going to knock nearly 750,000 of U.S. citizens out of their job because they won't be able to provide they will come up as non-confirmed because of the records not being correct in the E-Verify databases. It's a big hit to small businesses, billions of dollars, because they're going to have to divert resources so that they have the proper equipment and are able to use that kind of program. The Congressional Budget Office has scored E-Verify, and it would cost $17 billion over 10 years in a decrease in federal tax revenue, because what will happen is that workers will just get knocked off the rolls and get paid under the table. So it's, you know, three strikes and you're out for E-Verify, which is why there's been tremendous opposition to it by, frankly, Republicans and those in the Tea Party, and that while the bill did pass out of the House Judiciary Committee, it wasn't a smooth sail. And I would predict that it's going to come under a lot more scrutiny before it ever sees a light of day on the House floor. So while it's often portrayed as the magic fairy dust that will make unauthorized workers go away and legalize the workforce, far from it. What it'll do is hurt U.S. citizens, not stop unauthorized immigration, and cost U.S. taxpayers a lot of money.
One sign that there's problems with the federal E-Verify program is that Alabama has just recently unveiled its own verification program. I think they call it AliVerify or AlVerify. And it's intended to be, as I say, a verification program just for that state. So you see, if you have states going, each one of them passing their own immigration bill and each one of them having their own verification program, you're really going to have an unmanageable mess.
Gustavo, as you know, probably know, HB 87 mandates E-Verify and SAVE for municipalities and county governments. I went to the training program offered by Georgia Municipality Associations, and the E-Verify within the city is real now. We must E-Verify, as well as we have to ensure that our contractors, subcontractors, and sub-subcontractors are also using E-Verify. And the training is still ongoing, but it's not pleasant at all.
And I guess as a follow-up for Mr. Bridges, as the new board, the immigration board here in Georgia has started functioning, do you guys, or at least your city, has the money or the resources to face a fine or to encounter, to face a fine if they find something irregular in your city?
Our city government will comply with HB 87, and a concern that I raised during the training program was the composition of the 7-member voluntary group, where one of the members is listed with the Southern Poverty Law Center's hate groups, where his organization is, and I'm just saying that HB 87 in total has been a bad impact. It's holding a bad impact. It mandates that the government's USAVE, which costs 50 cents per inquiry and $25 per month, and you know, cities as poor as mine, we don't have that kind of money just lying around, but it's required by HB 87 to do that.
for those of you who aren't in Georgia, the question that was just raised is significant because this board, this seven-man board, which is an all-white, all-male board, and includes a very strong anti-immigration, not just anti-illegal immigration, but anti-immigration spokesman, has the power to bring criminal charges against public officials like Paul if they don't comply fully with this law.
They have the power to remove me from office, or at least to start the process to remove me from office if I don't comply with this law, and fine me and the city council members monetary damages or monetary fines, as well as removal from office.
And how about the, I mean, changing subjects a little bit, the mechanization of agriculture as some growers
are
considering.
And what was your specific question about that? I'm sorry.
Yeah, the impact or implications of, this possibility in changing from manual labor to mechanized labor.
Well, you mentioned that you had not been able to hear part of our presentation, but if you go to the report, we have some tables, I think, that really give you a very graphic representation of the difference in the value of hand-picked crops. And that's a value, by the way, we base this strictly on farm gate value. The value of fruits and vegetables per acre is much greater than peanuts or corn, which can be harvested mechanically. But even more than that, that money that comes off those acres that are planted in fruits and vegetables circulates much more because you have more hands involved in the process, and therefore you have more people like those busloads of Hispanics who come to the Walmart in Vidalia every weekend to buy goods. That whole small town economic circuit gets short wired through this.
Okay, thank you.
Once again, if you would like to ask a question, press star 1 now. And your next question is a follow up from Blake Ald.
There was a similar report that came out from, I think, the Georgia Fruits and Vegetable Growers Association today. Have y'all had a chance to take a look at that? And if so, how does it match up with the results that you found?
I haven't looked at it in detail, but it matches up pretty well. Blake, if you look at that report, what they did was to take the seven most heavily affected crops and to look at the economic impact from that. We took a somewhat broader scope, but those numbers, that at least the ones that I've seen in the Journal Constitution news story today, match up very well with the estimates. Also, estimates that have been done in other states, there was a similar sort of study done in Michigan a couple of years ago, and all of those studies point to losses of this magnitude.
Thank you very much, and thank you very much to all the participants. If you have any follow-up questions or would like to speak to either of the speakers later on today, you are welcome to give me a call directly at 202-478-6327.
Thank you. This concludes today's conference call. You may now disconnect.